No, I don't eat chocolate, but thank you.
We'll open up today's session of the House Committee on Healthcare. We're going to open up a public hearing first because we don't have quite a quorum. Unless a quorum comes in while I'm talking. I'd like to take this opportunity, though, to introduce three honorary pages from my district who are visiting here. Three left or only two? No. Would you guys stand up and introduce yourself? Where's...
I'm Grace Walker, and I'm homeschooled, and I'm in the 11th grade, and I'm from Portland.
Great. Thank you for coming.
I'm Silas Walker, and I'm in 8th grade, and I'm also homeschooled, and I'm also from Portland.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you both for coming. Stay as long as you feel like or leave when you have to. But maybe you'll find what we're doing interesting. And thanks for standing up. Was there another young gentleman who was here? Here he is. Great. Thank you very much for coming. And who's that young man next to you? Is he an honorary page also? All right, Brian, I won't pick on you. We got a quorum?
Well, Thompson just showed up and Hoyle just said 2, 4, 5.
We have a quorum.
We do.
Good. I'll open a work session on House Bill 2740. Madam Administrator, can you tell us what that one's about?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. House Bill 2740, you'll recall, directs the State Registrar of the Center for Health Statistics to send a certified copy of birth certificates to each child born in Oregon that are residents of the state to the Oregon 529 College Savings Board. It requires the board to send a notice to the parents of the child indicated on the birth certificate for the opportunity to open a college savings account. Directs the boards to make deposit from the 529 College Savings Network Fund into an account with the child as a designated beneficiary when the parent acknowledges the intent to establish such account. Requires the regular contributions by the parent to maintain the account. Directs the board to adopt the rules. This is effective July 1, 2012. Mr. Chair, this has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Also, on March 2nd, the committee adopted the -3 amendments. So,
and those amendments, but you don't have to send the certified copy anymore. It's just
correct.
The information.
Yeah. Correct. It was just the information.
No lugging boxes of certificates.
Right.
And I think this one's ready to go. Yep. Can I have a motion?
You have a motion. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2740 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation as the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Is there any discussion on the bill? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Doherty?
Yes.
Representative Parrish?
Excuse.
Representative Hoyle?
Yes.
Representative Weider?
Excused.
Excuse.
Aye.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Greenland?
Aye. Motion passes, and it's on its way. Close the work session on House Bill 2740. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3164. Is Representative Buckley here?
His
aide. Or his able aide. Come on. And we have also Patrick Conway.
Mouse is not working. They don't turn them
on. Do you want to bring him up at the same time?
It's not easy.
Sure. John Paul, why don't you all...
Here, Patrick.
Why don't you all come on up. Andrew, introduce yourself.
Sure. Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Ainsworth, and I'm here on behalf of Representative Buckley. Before you today, we have House Bill 3164, and Representative Buckley introduced this bill on behalf of some constituents down in Southern Oregon who work at the Rosewood Institute, which is a state-certified outpatient mental health clinic down in Southern Oregon. A situation recently arose there where the clinic or the institute was in the past able to bill insurers for services provided by the counselors at the clinic. And these counselors are not licensed counselors, but they are able to lawfully practice counseling services under the exemption set up in statute for those who practice at a state-certified clinic. So recently, some insurers have stopped reimbursing these the institute for the services provided by these counselors, and it's not all insurers, just a few. And the providers are currently eligible for reimbursement under ORS 743A, 168, paragraph 5, so that's the in section 2 of the statute there. However, it is contingent upon these counselors meeting the credentialing standards of the insurer themselves. So some of the insurers, part of the country requirements are the requirement is included in the requirement that these counselors be licensed, even though they're not required to be licensed under law. So this bill would make some, just remove that wording and make one other little adjustment to specify that these individuals are able to practice and receive reimbursement. I have Dr. Patrick Conaway here with me from Bend. He's the director of LifeWorks in Central Oregon. Our constituents from the Rosewood Institute weren't able to make it up. It is a rather large or far drive for them. So I hope he can explain more of the details of the bill, since I'm not really an expert in this area. He has on-the-ground knowledge of what goes on here.
Thank you. Thank you, Andrew. Can you hear me okay?
There we go.
Oh, here we go. Looking for the microphone. Thanks. So, thank you for allowing me to come before you after crossing the Great Snowy Divide this morning.
Please introduce yourself.
Yes, Dr. Patrick Conway, LifeWorks of Central Oregon, which is a outpatient mental health clinic in Bend. So, I'm here to explain why I think passage of this bill is important for so many Oregonians today who are suffering from life adjustment issues and mental disorders. I am director of LifeWorks of Central Oregon, which has operated continuously for 20 years as a state-certified mental health clinic. Our five clinicians include an assessment specialist, counselors, and psychiatric nurse practitioners. And we offer psychotherapy and medication management to the patients that come to see us from Central and Eastern Oregon. We are known by DHS as a Senate Bill 31 clinic. Now, most people have never heard of a Senate Bill 31 clinic. I know I hadn't until I became involved. But there are at least 38 such clinics operating in the state right now, including the Rosewood Institute, members of which originally approached Representative Buckley with the problems that this current legislation is designed to remedy. Let me take a moment to explain what these clinics are, because I think that will help put this bill in perspective. In 1989, recognizing that both the public itself and insurance carriers have a mutual interest in setting high standards for mental health services, the legislature passed the Senate Bill 31. SB 31 was codified in the OARs 309, 039, 050, which lay out the standards and rules for quality assurance that we operate by. These statutes and rules are administered by the Office of Mental Health and Addictions. And I think this original legislation was far-sighted and really helpful to the citizens of Oregon. It promoted best practices, ethical guidelines, financial transparency, and set educational criteria and qualification for staff. The intent was that once the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services certifies that an agency is compliant with these rules, Division 39 rules, it would be qualified to receive insurance reimbursement for services rendered to patients. It's important to note here, I think, that Senate Bill 31 clinics, SB 31 clinics, are not merely a group of clinicians sharing rent under a single roof. We function in a multidisciplinary way, taking a comprehensive approach to patient care. We use evidence-based practices, which are specified in the rules themselves. As providers, we hold twice monthly supervision meetings with a qualified supervisor, MD, PhD psychologist, LCSW or LPC, licensed professional counselor. In our case, we use a psychiatrist in Bend. We have to submit a treatment plan with measurable goals, and the plan must be reviewed and approved by the supervisor, and we must show improvement to justify continued treatment. In addition to individual supervision, all of our providers take part in a regular case review session with peers. Here, feedback and guidance is provided for the clinician who is treating the patient. I might add that these safeguards exceed anything that licensed practitioners must do in independent practice. The clinic structure is a learning community in the sense that we mean it's designed to continuously raise the quality of care and practice through peer supervision and accountability. The sorts of malpractice that we hear harm clients and that we occasionally hear about and wish to avoid, things like practices that have no basis in evidence, exploitation of patients, sexual transgressions, unwarranted treatment, and things like this are much less likely to occur within the context of an SB 31 clinic. Our clinic and other clinics in the state that are SB 31 clinics must undergo, and they have to pay DHS to conduct a thorough on-site review every 3 years in order to retain certification. Because these clinics operate as agencies rather than as individual practitioners, insurance billing and reimbursement is done under one tax ID number, and clinicians are then paid by the agency. While many of the providers within these agencies hold a license from a mental health board, there are a number of other long-serving, highly skilled clinicians who do not hold licenses, but all will have been verified to meet the standards set in Division 39 rules of a qualified mental health professional. That's a designation which is delineated in the rules. They have all clinicians, whether licensed or unlicensed, have to hold a master's degree in a mental health-related discipline, and they are subject to all these supervisory requirements. These clinicians have skill sets that are equal to, and in some cases exceed, those of their licensed colleagues. Our unlicensed providers are a crucial component to the treatment that we offer. I, for one, came to this work from a previous career as a professor of psychology and school psychologist. My licensed colleagues rely on my particular expertise in addressing their clinical needs. In addition, SB 31 clinics provide one of the very few settings in which a counselor or social worker intern can offer service and accumulate hours on the road to licensure. As long as insurance companies recognized and reimbursed us as an agency, the system worked well. And by and large, it worked well for 18 years until the passage of ORS 743A. When the legislature enacted that bill and gave parity to mental health services, it affirmed the importance of mental health treatment as a component of comprehensive health care. However, the legislation omitted reference to state-certified agencies, and insurance companies begin to ignore the provisions that have been carefully set up in these Division 39 rules. Insurance companies began to arbitrarily deny claims when services in the agency involved a non-licensed but still highly qualified practitioner. My colleagues report many instances where this has seriously disrupted the care for many patients. Last week in our own clinic, a patient with a chronic degenerative disease, recently divorced, isolated, and unemployed, had worked to establish an effective treatment relationship with one of our providers. But then she found herself unable to access the care when her insurance carrier abruptly decided to terminate reimbursing services for the counselor she had been seeing, even though this unlicensed counselor had been approved by the state under the very set of rules that were created for the purposes of gaining insurance reimbursement. Because of the financial and occupational losses that are occurring during these challenging times now, county mental health programs are relying more and more on to deal with the escalating demands for mental health services on our SB 31 clinics. So we're seeing in our own clinic a threefold increase of OHP clients, which are seen at very low rates. So we rely, and we continue to rely on private health insurance reimbursement to help meet these costs. I'm going to wrap this up now. I urge the committee to recommend passage of this bill, remedying an oversight in the original legislation, restoring reimbursement for all providers in these important facilities, and honoring the intent of ORS 743A, which is to increase access to mental health care, to improve and maintain the health of the citizens of this state. Passage of this measure removes an anomaly and costs the taxpayer nothing. In fact, it may save money in the long run, because as the research shows, access to outpatient care averts the more costly measures down the road, such as emergency room visits, domestic violence, incarceration, and inpatient hospitalization. Thank you. I've prepared a summary of these points for committee members, and also a list of the SB 31 clinics that are currently certified in Oregon.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Andrew or for Dr. Conrad?
I'll wait until I hear the other testimony.
Okay. Hang in.
Hi.
Ready?
Good for me.
Okay. Is that too familiar?
No.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Co-Chair Thompson, my name is John Powler, Regent of the Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, here today to express some concerns about House Bill 3164. And, Mr. Chair and members, when the Mental Health Parity Act was passed, this language in the act was specifically removed at our request. We have nothing negative to say about the clinics and their attempt to provide county mental health services. However, there were quality concerns in some cases, and cases where the insurer, because the law simply said we had to reimburse them, we did not have any credentialing capabilities to assure adequate services to our members. So we would oppose passage of House Bill 3164 for those reasons.
No?
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Conway, I guess I'd like to know, you say these people are well-trained and competent, and why they're not licensed then?
Well, for several reasons. As I indicated, one of the reasons is that we have people who have approached or entered mental health profession some time ago, and the licensure regulations that have been developed in recent years by these boards are specifically geared to the present curricula for training in the universities. They do not necessarily reflect that the content that that's being reflected is any different than what it was once before, but many of these people practicing in the clinic entered some time ago as clinicians, and they continue to get experience, and the quality of their work is, as I say, supervised. We have we're required by DHS to meet these criteria, which of a qualified mental health professional, which, as I understand, are still on the books.
So who supervises them? Second question.
Well, we have each facility has either a psychiatrist, a licensed psychologist, a clinical social worker, or a licensed professional counselor, or we have a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner reviewing all treatment plans and supervising the treatment process.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just one last comment.
Go for it.
I'll have to go back and look at Senate Bill 31 since I was there and voted on it.
Other questions? John, is there some way to make this, you talk about credentialing, is there some way to make this more acceptable?
Mr. Chair, I will seek an answer to that question. I don't know whether it is, and personally, I'm not familiar enough with these clinics to be able to make a judgment on the spot.
If you've done a little bit of work on it, then check in with Representative Buckley's office.
We'll do.
See if it might be some way to credential these folks in an independent process for the insurance companies. It might be helpful. But, so let's see where we're going. Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Powell, if these people were licensed, they would be reimbursable. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair,
assuming the diagnosis was
Representative Kenemer, I believe they would be if they were credentialed by the insurer. And
I see. Yeah. That's true. Mm-hmm.
And is it true that you all used to pay for their services?
Mr. Co-Chair, it used to be in the law that you just had to pay for their services regardless of...
I mean, since the law changed, Did you continue to pay for them, or did you?
Mr. Chair, I don't know how many are paid. If the billing as was described, they may pay for some and not know if it comes through a certain code.
Yes.
I can speak from our clinic that we, in fact, at Regents does pay, is one of the companies that does pay for care in our clinic. We were, and so they, some companies do. The issue has been that we, as clinics, have met the required, the legislation in SB 31 was set up for the purpose of certifying programs for insurance reimbursement. And the intent was if these standards were met, it would provide some assurance to the insurance industry that it would be able to, with confidence that it was paying for quality care for patients. So that was the intent. And what has happened now since the passage of 743A is that insurance companies are now ignoring the clinic structure that we have complied with to guarantee quality of care, and which we feel in some cases is superior to private practitioners who don't have to meet these requirements. So that's, I think, my next, from our point of view, some insurance companies are stepping up and paying, others are not. So I don't know about the motives of insurance companies for denying care. I'm not aware of any citation or any reason in action against a SB 31 clinic that would question the quality of care.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ainsworth. Will you keep in touch? See where we're going. And thank you for coming over the snow.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Drive safely.
Yeah, I'll drive carefully going back.
I will.
Close the public hearing on 3164. And. She's hiding. And open up a public hearing on. House Bill 3246, and ask Representative Kotek to join us. Do you want to talk about both of them? All three have your name on. You want to talk about all three? Your pleasure.
We have different folks.
Okay. Why don't you stay with us for a while?
Like old times.
It is like old times.
Good afternoon, co-chairs Thompson and Greenlick. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. It's good to see you all. I miss the thrills of the Healthcare Committee.
We miss you, too.
So today we're going to start off with House Bill 3246. Testimony is being passed around. There's been a lot of discussion over the interim and during the session already about the importance of primary care providers and what we can do either through loan forgiveness or loan repayments or residency slots, ways to improve the pipeline. As we all know, that it's very important to make sure we have adequate capacity for primary care providers if we're really going to get a handle on containing costs and spending our dollars at the front end instead of the back end. House Bill 3246 is one possible strategy to right-size how we compensate for primary care in Oregon while holding down overall costs at the same time. The bill would require any health plan doing business with the state to submit a five-year plan to the Oregon Health Policy Board on how it will increase payments to primary care providers by decreasing rates for specialty care. Insurance plans would have the opportunity to find out what works for them by making clear that increasing payment for primary care providers should not be reason to pour more money into a lopsided system. The gap in payment between primary care providers and specialists would probably still exist. I wouldn't see that changing, but maybe the gap between those two types of providers would shrink. This bill came out of a discussion with my staff and from doing some reading around what was happening in Rhode Island. The Rhode Island, they actually have a health insurance commissioner in Rhode Island, the only one in the country. We have an insurance commissioner, but they have specifically a health insurance commissioner. His name is Christopher Kohler, and he's been looking at ways to improve care in his state. And using his position as insurance commissioner, he required Rhode Island's insurers to increase how much their medical expenses go to primary care by 1 percentage point each year for 5 years, 5 years running. So I was thinking about what they were doing there and thinking, well, if we want plans to participate with our programs here, how do we get them to really think about primary care? So that's what you see in front of you today. We're going to hopefully, I think the insurance division is going to be speaking on this bill. They are trying to work on, not necessarily the concept in this bill, but trying to figure out how to work with insurance plans to invest more in primary care. And so hopefully we'll hear about their ideas. And again, this is clearly a conversation piece, but certainly something to think about. If we're going to contain the overall cost of care, we just can't be talking about paying primary care providers more. And by doing so, potentially over time, just in continuing to increase the cost for specialty care. I think there has to be some linkage there if we're really going to get a handle on the overall cost of health care. So with that, I urge your support of the bill. Look forward to discussion, and we'll end with that. Thank you.
Great. Want to hang in?
Absolutely.
We'll ask Teresa Miller and Tom Holt to join us.
Mr.
Brian Barringer will be next.
While they're coming up, also we just passed out written testimony commenting on House Bill 3046 from ODS for the record.
Teresa, why don't you start?
Sure. Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Teresa Miller. I'm the administrator of the Insurance Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here just to talk a little bit about the Rhode Island experience related to promoting primary care, as well as efforts underway here in Oregon on this issue. As Representative Kotek indicated, the Rhode Island Health Insurance Commissioner did direct insurers to increase medical expenses devoted to primary care over a five-year period. Rhode Island insurers were spending on average about 5.9% of medical expenditures on primary care in 2008. So the goal was that by 2014, 11% of commercial insurers' medical expenses would be devoted to primary care. Increasing spending on primary care was part of a broader plan that also included promotion of medical homes, electronic health records, and more comprehensive payment reform. And these priorities, of course, are also priorities here in Oregon, and many of those efforts are being led by the Oregon Health Authority. We appreciate the concept behind House Bill 3246 and the interest in controlling costs in healthcare in ways that will improve quality for patients. As some of you probably know, we are looking for ways that we can use our health insurance rate review process to try to help in this process. Because partly we recognize that until we get a handle on medical costs, even the most open and detailed rate review process will fail to make insurance significantly more affordable for consumers and small businesses. Historically, rate review processes have focused on the annual increase in claims costs, administrative expenses, and profit. Agency actuaries review an insurer's assumptions in each of these categories to determine whether or not the rate increase is justified. After ensuring that the medical cost trends are supported by claims data, insurance regulators typically in Oregon and across the country don't drill further into those medical costs themselves. One reason is that trend is based largely on negotiated contracts between insurers and providers. But we think it's time to begin asking whether or not we can influence that insurer-provider contracting process to try to lower costs. So, for example, should Oregon require insurers to spend a minimum amount on primary care similar to what Rhode Island did? Should we reject proposed rate increases if certain provider costs go up by more than X percent a year? We're interested to study the Rhode Island experience, but we also recognize that Oregon's market is significantly different from Rhode Island, so we also want to look at what else we can do here in Oregon to impact healthcare costs. With federal grant funds, we have hired a consulting firm to explore all of these ideas, and our consultants will soon be meeting with stakeholders, providing, getting feedback from stakeholders, and then providing recommendations to the department by fall of 2011. And our hope is that we'll have some new ideas then for ways we can continue to improve our rate review process, and hopefully some ideas that will help us address what's actually driving premium increases, which is healthcare costs. Clearly, though, what we do related to our rate review process is really a very small part of a much larger strategy to promote delivery system reform in Oregon. So I think Rhode Island should certainly be complimented on their approach to expanding primary care, but I think it is important to also point out that Oregon has implemented a number of initiatives that are far more encompassing, including expanding medical homes, new payment models for primary care, information technology and medical records, administrative simplification, care management models that are being modeled in 14 major clinics throughout the state, incorporating incorporation of value-based benefit designs in the large group market, along with PEB and OEB, patient safety initiatives, and so on. I think the cooperation between the Oregon Health Policy Board, the Oregon Health Authority, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and the Healthcare Leadership Task Force in addressing delivery system change is actually much more comprehensive than what has been attempted by many states. So I appreciate the committee's time and the opportunity to just share some of the efforts underway in Oregon to try and address this issue. And I appreciate Representative Kotek bringing this bill forward to have the conversation.
Are you saying this bill would help you do what you want to do anyway?
Mr. Kotek, we don't need this bill to do what we're going to do. We're going to do a study and actually have started that study now, and we'll be getting recommendations back. So regardless of what happens with the bill, we will be doing that.
Questions? Mr. Holt?
Co-Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Want to compliment Representative Kotek of bringing a little different twist to the issue of making better use of primary care versus specialists, and it's something that we try to do in our business every day with the way that we contract with providers. But I would suggest that there's a lot of complexities in this area beyond a hydraulic between pay specialists less and primary care more. And to give you an example, we see in the OMIT pool that we administer, there's some patients within that pool who, by their nature, need to make high use of specialists, the hemophilia population, for example, versus others who are in the high-risk pool because they have a high-cost chronic condition that may well be best managed through a primary care provider. And through our contracting methods, we try to encourage the appropriate use of primary care as the starting point for the patient's care so that there's good continuity of care and then use of the specialists when they should be used. All that said, I think, you know, as presented, we would be in reluctant opposition to the bill, but concur in the idea that we all need to do better in, you know, managing the resources that we have, and we're doing a lot of work in that area now as we look, in partly in response to questions from our own customers, that, you know, are we at the right level for what we're doing with primary care versus others, and what do our utilizations look like versus other markets that are kind of similar, and things of that nature. So, you know, I think the problem that we would have with a bill of this nature is that as we're going through a lot of efforts to really implement payment reforms on our own and within the market in collaboration with providers, we see as a little bit tying our hands in what creativity we might be able to have going forward to, you know, get to the same place that I think we all want to get to of making better use of primary care and better use of specialists.
Question, Mr. Holt? Yes. Anybody?
Yeah, I guess for Mr. Holt primarily, you're asking for continued latitude because, as if I understood you correctly, you're working on this effort already. But I didn't hear what it is about this bill that you believe would stand in the way of your efforts to shift towards primary care where appropriate.
Chair Greenlich, Representative Cannon, the way we would read the bill is that it's rather prescriptive in saying that there's a hydraulic between the specialist and the primary care and having to lay out a five-year plan of exactly how you're going to go about it. I think many of us, if we were able to spin the clock back 5 years from today, we're all doing a lot of things in the system now that were almost unimaginable to be done 5 years ago even. And so it just seems a little bit restrictive from our standpoint.
I appreciate that, and I don't think anyone's intent would be to tamp down on the creativity with which we'll need to approach this problem. I don't read the bill quite as restrictively as I think you might, or it sounds like you might. It would require you to submit a plan. It doesn't appear to have it does not appear to require a it requires updates on progress. Presumably you would be able to you know, to revise the plan as you go. Maybe we could, if there's interest in the committee on moving down this path, maybe we could figure out just how restrictive it is. I think probably less rather than more. I think it's just vitally important that we use, that the state, and this bill is really about the state and our contracting, that the state uses reimbursement rates as a tool to help shift towards lower cost, better outcome care. And, you know, encourage, if it's not this bill, encourage you to work, as I know you're doing, with the legislature, with the division, with the plans to move in that direction. Is that a question?
Senator Thompson?
A couple of questions. I don't see where this bill addresses the shortage of primary care providers and how we're going to get out from under that cloud. First of all, and secondly, connected with that, by making it unfavorable to refer to a specialist, are we boxing in the primary care providers or discouraging them from referring a patient to a specialist when that may be in the specialist or in the patient's best interest, or the specialist's best interest for that? But it looks like maybe we're getting a cart before the horse here. I know what you're trying to do, but I don't know how this formula brings us more primary care people that we really need to solve the problem.
Mr. Co-Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, thank you for the question. On the first part, do I have any clear evidence that this would necessarily help? No, but we have a lot of conversation about one way to encourage the pipeline and get more people in the primary care is to pay them more. We all talk about that. So here's one way to go about it with a, if you will, an offset mechanism in some ways. I think your second question, I don't think, and this bill to some degree is crudely composed, but we could make some changes to it to make sure we aren't impacting quality of care and that relationship between the primary care and the specialist. You know, I just know as a PEB member and for a short time was in the Providence Choice part of the PEB plan, which is the patient-centered medical home model that they're trying to encourage folks to use. I was struck by how much we, you know, had a primary care visit versus a specialty visit and the gap between what we were paying per hour. And at some point, if you continue to pay primary care folks more and you continue to pay at the same differential to specialty care, I don't know how you eventually get some kind of constraint here. I'm not saying that specialty care is bad. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be a linkage. But when you're spending $200 an hour for a primary care visit and it's $600 an hour for a specialist, at some point you say, really, $400 more an hour? At some point, is that where you look for a way to pay a little bit more on the front end and a little less on the back end? So,
I guess the piece I'm missing is the incentive here, because by requiring insurance companies to change this formula seems to imply to me that they want to pay the specialist more money, and I don't think that's the case. I think my guess is if there must be some other dynamic working here, because if I'm paying and I can hire somebody for $200 an hour to do the job, I'm certainly not going to just acquiesce to, oh, what the heck, let's pay $600. So there must be something else going on in this dynamic, which may be the shortage of primary care or something else, but I'm thinking maybe this may not be purely what the fault of insurance companies. And that throwing them under the bus might not be the solution, but I'm open.
Mr. Co-Chair, good questions. And that's why part of the reason I wanted to get the bill out there is so we could talk about this. Yeah. I guess what I would say to that is that it's not, again, necessarily saying that specialty care is bad. I think there's some market issues, but what this bill is asking for is for the plans to intentionally think about this and the linkages between those things and say, we're going to talk about this, have a plan, and try to get to some way to pay primary care more without at the same time increasing the overall global budget. And maybe it's not specialty care, but if you just talk about paying primary care providers more and don't do anything else in any other part of the system, that doesn't do anything around cost containment.
Yeah, it's interesting, Representative Thompson, you talk about scarcity, and it really reminded me that in a normal market, if there was a scarce product like primary care compared to a glut like some of the specialties,
the market would drive the price of the scarce one up and the price of the common one down. It doesn't work that way in healthcare, which is interesting. Yeah,
but does that mean the market sees a benefit?
No, it means the market's failing. It's a market. I mean, that's literally what it... I mean, it's seriously. It's not following the dynamics of a market.
I'm suggesting study this a little more deeply.
Yeah, we're going to ask the...
I don't understand the dynamics. I don't understand the dynamics, but...
Well, fortunately, we have DCBS on the case. So yeah.
Well, and I'd like to ask Mr. Holt. Ms. Miller gave some percentages of primary and secondary care, the relationship. Do you know what the percentages are?
Chair Greenlick, I don't know off the top of my head. I'd
really
be happy to try and get some numbers for you.
Yeah, wouldn't hurt to get it from Providence, too, and maybe Kaiser. I don't see anybody from Kaiser sitting here. But it'd be interesting to find out how we compare to the numbers they're trying to... I wouldn't be surprised if we're closer to where they're trying to get than we think they are, because we have a relatively low use of hospitalization, and that would be on the specialty care side. So it might be the case. We have an OMA representative signed up. You're lurking in the back. One of you would excuse the chair. Oh, you're all running. Okay. Ryan, please introduce yourself.
Lurking
back there. I was watching.
Chair Greenlick, Chair Thompson, members of the committee, my name is Brian Beringer, and I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. And I think a lot has been said, and we also certainly appreciate this discussion coming forward, because we've been having this discussion in several areas. And the OMA definitely believes that primary care is vital to our healthcare system, and we also recognize that primary care is terribly under-reimbursed right now. We also appreciate the intent of House Bill 3246 and think it should be a starting point to a larger conversation about payment system and, frankly, delivery system reform. Reform of Oregon's payment system cannot happen in a vacuum, and increasing primary care physician pay without reforming the delivery system to incent desired outcomes will only perpetuate financing problems with our current healthcare system. As all of you know, and most of you sit on, the governor's health system transformation team has been called together to address some of these issues, and this is on top of the work of the Oregon Health Policy Board, and specifically their payment reform work in the Incentives and Outcomes Committee for the last 2 years. While the governor's budget contemplates deep cuts to providers in the first year of the budget, the transformation team is working on redesigning our healthcare system, realigning incentives, and integrating our healthcare system to capture efficiencies in the second year of the budget. When we're talking about payment reform, we shouldn't limit the discussion, and I think that's really the gist of our points to this bill. Discussions about increasing primary care should occur alongside the larger discussion of payment reform and should include input from all physicians and providers as the system is redesigned better to achieve the triple aim. Primary increases should come from a number of places: eliminating inappropriate specialty care, eliminating inappropriate hospitalization, eliminating inappropriate use of drugs, and frankly, eliminating inappropriate primary care if we create a system that then would incent that. Again, we appreciate the sentiment of the bill, and we would like to see payment reform happen in conjunction with delivery system, and with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Let's see. It's not a support or a reject, right? That's a
Mr. Chair, yeah.
Great idea. Let's talk about it.
I think we could support, I think, the larger discussion. And I think, like Representative Kotek said, this is really a starting point to that larger discussion. And I think none of us will argue that primary care is funded where it needs to be. And I think the other thing, too, is none of us would argue that specialty care is going to be one of the solutions there. But I think there's some other pieces that obviously need to be in the discussion. And beyond just the payment reform, I think what we're talking about and what we've been talking about for the last 2 years and then 2 years with Oregon Health Fund Board and then, you know, 329 beyond that is delivery reform as well, and I think they all should be part of the discussion.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, sir.
Happy to help.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3246. As we'll stay in order and open a public hearing in House Bill 393559. Senator Kotek? Honors. I take it we're not doing a work session on 2271 today.
Just public hearing.
We're here.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Thank you for, again, the opportunity to talk about another bill, House Bill 3559. This bill is an attempt to implement a key recommendation of the Health Incentives and Outcomes Committee of the Oregon Health Policy Board, namely the goal to standardize payment methodology for inpatient and outpatient care in order to provide a foundation for aligning incentives, improve transparency in healthcare pricing, and help to reduce administrative costs. This bill is about leveraging the purchasing power of the state to take a critical first step towards payment reform. The current lack of consistency around how payments are calculated makes it close to impossible to compare costs for the same events across Oregon hospitals. Knee replacement surgery at a hospital in Portland is paid for differently than knee replacement surgery at a hospital in Bend, even though there are clear evidence-based methods for what components are necessary for a safe knee replacement surgery. As the legislature looks for significant system-wide savings, we need clarity on what we are paying for so we can make apples-to-apples comparisons across the system. This bill lays the groundwork for that clarity. House Bill 3559 would standardize payment for publicly purchased inpatient and outpatient care by tying payment to available Medicare methodology. While not perfect, using Medicare as the basis to establish standardization would be the most expedient, as Medicare's methodology are the most widely used methods. The bill allows for necessary innovation and flexibility and calls for the convening of a work group to help develop the implementing rules. The bill, as introduced, applies to care purchased by plans under the Public Employees Benefits Board and the Oregon Educators Benefit Board. The Dash 2 Amendment, you have a copy of, great. The Dash 2 Amendment clarifies that the payment standardization would also apply to services provided to medical assistance recipients, for example, Oregon Health Plan recipients, and plans under the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. So the Dash 2 gets all the publicly purchased PEB, OEP, medical assistance programs, and OMIP. The Dash 2 amendment also includes language for establishing a civil penalty for noncompliance. As noted already, the call for this legislation comes from the work of the Payment Reform Subcommittee of the Oregon Health Policy Board. During the interim, there were a variety of stakeholders who met to find ways to achieve payment reform. Standardizing payment methods was a strategy recommended by the Policy Board as a first step towards restructuring payment around value. I think I'll leave it at that. I think there are several folks who want to testify. This bill is really important, I think, if we're going to get a handle on the costs of doing business here in the state for inpatient and outpatient care. I would love to see this bill amended and worked and sent on to the Ways and Means Committee, because preliminary estimates show that this would also help us add some dollars available to reduce our budget problems in the Oregon Health Authority. So we can have a longer discussion about that in Ways and Means, but this is a critical bill, really gets at one of the first recommendations out of the Oregon Health Policy Board. And I look forward to the conversation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll save money in addition to the 20% cut that's going to happen. Good. Okay.
Nice shot.
I've been trying to alternate panels. Let's see how that works. We'll start with three pros, two neutrals, and three again. So the three pros are, let me see if I can get this right, Martin Taylor, Justin Black, and Arthur Towers. Then the next panel will be Judy Moore Peterson and Janine Smith. And the last panel will be Patty O'Sullivan, Dave Fiskum, and Tom Holt. Somebody sitting in the middle?
Arthur was here. I don't know what happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
You see if Arthur's out there?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Members of the committee, my name is Justin Black. I'm from the Oregon Education Association. We represent about 45,000 education employees across the state, most of whom are covered under OEP. You know, in the 2007 legislature, the legislature created OEB in an effort to help control costs, healthcare costs for school employees around the state. We believe to a degree OEB has done that. But one of the other things that I think you guys were hoping for was a large purchaser to help bring costs down everywhere. We hope that this bill would use OEB's purchasing power to help bring costs down for our members, for school districts across the state, and hopefully by including PEB, OMIP, and others under OHA, bring healthcare costs down for a number of folks. Really, I think it's important to point out that this really just creates a standardization for methodology, creates some transparency. It doesn't dictate price, so this is not a price fix, but this will give OEB and PEB and others the ability to share negotiations, information with negotiations, and to help bring down rates. And I will leave it that short.
Chair Greenlick and Chair Thompson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor with CARE Oregon. Mine's not going to be terribly short. I'm going to borrow just a little of Judson's time. But to be clear, we did not have any, no, there's no yield, but we didn't have anything to do with introducing this bill. And historically, Medicaid plans, including CARE Oregon, have been a little reluctant to invite the legislature into the payment methodology question. And there is, in fact, a range of experience with contracts that are better set up on a percentage of charge. Sometimes that works to a plan's advantage. Sometimes it works to a plan's disadvantage. Sort of depends on the contract and the arrangements between those plans and those providers. But we are testifying in favor of this bill for a couple of reasons. And the first is to take a look at our present circumstance. If you're a policymaker in this state, you need to have some predictability in your cost at this point, and percentage of charge contracts are inherently unpredictable, and that the charge can go up from the hospital at any time during the contract, and you're paying a percentage of it, but they control what the charge is through a charge master. That, for us, sometimes is a problem. Sometimes we move into a contract, and by the end of the contract, we're paying a lot more than we expected. There's also the question of percentage of charge contracts being inherently less transparent, because charges are built by hospitals in ways that you can't see, and we as the plan can't see. We can't go in and see how they built a charge master. We actually have a current problem right now with exactly that question. If you're trying, as Representative Kotek described, to have the system be more accountable and say, why is a knee replacement surgery in one place a different charge than knee replacement surgery in a different place, you have much less ability to do that in a percentage of charge contract environment. There's also a certain amount of gaming that goes on in the system, both to the plans and to the patients. In a percentage of charge contract, we've had a real experience where we identified a place where a hospital was taking very intense ICU babies and charging us at the most intense level right until the day of their discharge, where clearly those babies couldn't have been that intense the day of discharge or they wouldn't have been released. So we stopped paying some of those claims, negotiated, realized that we owed less, and the response from the hospital was to take the charge for that unit and double it so that they ended up netting the same amount of money. That's what can happen in the gaming of a percentage of charge contract. If you're a patient, likewise, it can be gaming because different charges in different units allow hospitals to move patients into a unit where they're most likely to get paid the percentage of charge to that unit services. So as a patient, you have less confidence. Now, I'm not saying that that goes on as a norm. I'm simply saying that in a system around accountability or transparency, there's less of that. There's also a leverage question. Very large hospitals like to be in percentage of charge contracts, and frankly, plans can't not contract with very large hospitals, particularly when you depend on them for your specialty care. To not contract and go to a non-par status for Medicaid plan would mean that our patients wouldn't get regular visits with their specialty providers that they depend on. So to some extent, we're in a vulnerable position in that we have to contract, and they insist on percentage of charge contracts. So while we have not traditionally supported having the state involved in our contracting relationships for a variety of reasons, we're now in a point of time where accountability and transparency are more important, and frankly, we're all about to have to renegotiate a lot of contracts with huge rate cuts, so there's some logic to this. But this, I think, is the most important point I want to make. I sort of saved the punchline for the end. Going forward in a transformed system, any transformation is going to make this assumption, that Medicaid is going to be a money loser for hospitals, that they're going to lose money on Medicaid. So they're not going to want to be in a contract situation where they're seeing many, many Medicaid patients. The best contract situation for a hospital is one where you've now designed a system where cost avoidance is the most important thing for hospitals, that there are fewer ER visits and fewer hospital days, that is, fewer opportunities to lose money on Medicaid patients. We need a new payment method. And we need a new payment method that resembles some that are described in this bill, bundling or capitation or other shared risk scenarios where providers at the primary care setting are helping us do the job of keeping people out of the hospital setting. So the future that's coming probably does involve having different payment methods than the ones we've got. And this bill sort of acknowledges that in this bridge of maybe 6 to 12 months before transformation happens, but we're all asked to survive on a different rate structure. And I think that's an important bridge for us. I would also just like to make three quick points on the bill. One is the language moves between the singular and the plural on payment methods a lot. I draw your attention on the bill to Section 1, Sub 2. The health authority may prescribe a uniform payment methodology. In Sub 3, it also describes a uniform payment methodology. And in Sub 4, in Section 2A, it describes the payment methodology. Elsewhere in the bill, in 2 Sub A, it describes Medicare payment methodologies. And in B, includes payment methodologies. And C, allows for the use of alternate payment methodologies. This difference is important. Are we asking the state's Oregon Health Authority to come up with one payment methodology that will work everywhere in the state for every emerging CCO, for every plan hospital relationship? Or are we saying, in the bucket of ways that you might pay for plans, we're ruling out percentage of charge, but we're opening up what the bill describes, a number of possibilities, bundling, capitation, Medicare methodology, there's a list, pay for performance. I would actually prefer the latter, some flexibility in the system, recognizing that you have a lot of different kinds of relationships, but I think one way or the other you have to be clear in the bill which direction you're going. I'd also like to mention that I really like Section 1, Sub 4, because it involves the consumers in this conversation. I think any time you move from a payment methodology that consumers are familiar with to something that might look like capitation, you need to bring the consumer along with you. Otherwise, they feel like you're making money in the system by denying them care. That's not the intent here, I realize, but if you don't have the consumer involved in that, they can get that impression. And a final observation is that there is a section that exempts Type A and Type B hospitals. I totally understand why you would have that in there. In fact, there's a statutory language about what Type A and Type B hospitals get paid. But if you're looking at new payment methodologies 12 months from now in a system that looks like a a transformed system, that transformed system, I think, is going to assume that the providers in a region are all in the same global budget. And to carve out Type A and B hospitals from that global budget probably is inconsistent with where you're going. So I don't have any problem with that being in this bill as it relates to the existing system, but I would check this against where you want to go with your future system, if you will, and make sure that it's still going to make sense for whatever comes out of your Wednesday night groups. Thanks.
Any questions? Yes, sir.
Is there anything in present regulation or statute that prevents the authority from doing this? We're requiring them in this bill, but short of requiring them, can they do it anyway?
You have expert, and Judy Moore Peterson, who could testify on that. To be honest, our position has been that we haven't wanted the state to be telling us how we have to contract with hospitals in the past, and what this bill is really doing is excluding a method and then potentially setting up an alternative or a set of alternatives. I would ask the state how much flexibility they feel like they currently have.
Sure.
What I'm getting at, and this isn't the only bill.
Certainly, I bet the state does not have the authority to impose something like this.
We have a number of bills that are giving direction to the health authority,
mm-hmm.
and I'm getting the impression that we're very close to drowning them in directions when maybe given a little latitude, they might get some of these things done of their own volition across a system,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to us telling them by bill what they're going to do on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Let them take the whole thing and go figure it out and see where that takes us.
It's a transformation, right?
Yeah. So I'm a little concerned about too much direction from us.
Well, but they may literally not have the authority.
It could be. That's the question, yeah. But
Representative Kenner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciated your example of your comments about gaming, and I thought it was a splendid example. I guess as I was stewing about that, I was reflecting on Mr. Black's comment that it doesn't really do price fixing. But I guess that's the opposite side of the game, is it not? And that's what I worry about in this bill.
Well, I think that you have a current system that's got all kinds of flaws, and in the scale of flaws, this is probably not the biggest. The question is really, where do you want to go? And if where you want to go is to incentivize care that keeps people out of the most expensive pieces of our healthcare system, keeps people healthy, the current system rewards, and this payment method rewards, many episodes of care at the highest levels of care. And this is a logical piece to come out of the system that you've got if you're trying to do cost containment.
Martin, you made an assumption that I'm not sure is a correct assumption, and we may want to take it offline, but let me put it on record here. And that's that I'm not sure it always is in the hospital's best interest not to have a Medicaid patient. The question is, how many empty beds do they have? And if they have empty beds, then the question is, what's the relationship between the fixed cost and the variable cost of a patient? Because it might be, if the fixed costs are 50% and you get 84% of your costs on a Medicare patient, you're better off getting that 50% of fixed costs out of that patient, even though you're having to pay for the variable cost. So that's an issue that...
I mean, I'm sure the Hospital Association is better to address that question, but let's make an assumption that for all of us, the less expensive system is to have the unfilled bed, and that if the hospitals have the dilemma of a capacity, but they're willing partners in trying to reduce the need for ER visits and hospitalization, that we can have some shared savings plan where hospitals can, if that cost exists, have that cost offset by the greater public good served by having fewer people in the hospital.
Absolutely. And also probably the better health good.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm going to suspend the hearing, not close, the hearing on 3559, and open a public hearing on House Bill 2271. Representative Kotek has some time constraints, and we'll let her open that up, and then we'll come back into the order again.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Is this having me all in one day?
Is this
payback for not
day.
Being, on,
yeah,
being no. on the committee?
Oh,
I'll be back on Wednesday.
Yeah, we have another one on Wednesday.
So, House Bill 2271. This one's got a little more pizzazz than the other ones. This talks about never events, things that shouldn't happen. It also talks about requiring the use of evidence-based surgical checklists, which you'll remember from 2009 was something of an interest of mine. A never event is a term used to describe, as you see on line 6 and 7 of the bill, quote, any serious reportable event identified by the National Quality Forum for which Medicare denies payment in full or in part, unquote. Never events are preventable incidents that happen to patients in healthcare settings, mostly hospitals. These events are so egregious that they should never happen, but if they do, no patient or patient's insurance plan should have to pay for them. The list of never events compiled by the National Quality Forum and not covered by Medicare includes such things as surgery performed on the wrong body part, surgery performed on the wrong patient, unintended retention of a foreign object in a patient's body, patient death or serious disability associated with the use of contaminated drugs, devices, or biologics provided by the healthcare facility, and patient death or serious disability associated with a transfusion of the wrong blood type. I think you get my point here about what's preventable. Preventable medical errors kill and seriously injure thousands of Americans every year. A report released in November of last year by the Office of the Inspector General at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services found that 1 in 7 Medicare patients are injured during hospital stays, and that these adverse events during the course of care cost the federal government and taxpayers an additional $4.4 billion annually, not to mention the negative impacts on the patients and their families. So across across the nation here in Oregon, insurance plans are establishing policies of not paying for never events. Medicare has not paid for some of them since October 2008, and starting this year, the Oregon Health Plan won't pay for them either. This legislation expands on that movement by prohibiting any hospital or ambulatory surgical center in Oregon from charging for a serious reportable event not covered by Medicare. Enacting such a law will recognize and support where the federal government and the insurance industry is headed in terms of protecting patients and controlling costs. It's not, however, enough to say we won't pay for things that shouldn't happen after they happen. It's important to encourage prevention in our healthcare facilities as well. The routine use of surgical checklists is one critical prevention tool. Used to enhance communication and clarify tasks before an operation begins, these checklists have been shown to reduce the risk of major complications by 35% and deaths by 47%. Fortunately, the use of surgical checklists is already widespread in Oregon. In 2009, the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems testified to this committee that they would voluntarily work to help Oregon hospitals pilot and implement the use of surgical checklists, with the goal of full implementation by the end of 2009. You'll hear today from the association, as well as the Oregon Patient Safety Commission, I believe, about the positive effects of surgical checklists in our hospitals. In recognition of ongoing efforts in this area and the potential need to reduce any fiscal impact on the Oregon Health Authority in drafting rules to implement Section 5 of the bill, I've had amendments drafted to remove the mandatory use of surgical checklists. That's the dash one. Certainly up to the committee if they want to do that, but just wanted to provide that option. And since the introduction of the bill, it also came to my attention that any potential civil penalty for violating Section 2 might best be handled by allowing the Attorney General to bring an action against violators of the law rather than the Director of the Oregon Health Authority, as you see in the bill. So I'm working on an amendment on that as well. That's why we're not ready for a work session today, although I look forward to coming back and working this bill and making those amendments part of the bill. And thank you for your time, and I'll take any questions, but I know there are other folks who also want to speak to the bill. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Oh, and I have testimony.
I noticed that this prohibits healthcare facilities. What about the surgeon? An healthcare facility didn't leave the scalpel in somebody, the surgeon did. And usually the hospital bill is separate from the surgeon's bill. Is the surgeon covered on this? Or other person?
Mr. Co-Chair, that's a good question. I believe the way that's written, person refers to hospital facility or a healthcare facility, but we could look into that. It does not speak to the actual provider, but you do raise a good point, depending on who's doing the billing.
It seems like the fault lies with the person in charge of the patient, not particularly with the facility that wasn't in the room at the time it happened.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kircher, I think it depends on how it's set up. I mean, if you're if the surgery is taking place in your hospital and you've established a hospital policy, for example, to do things a certain way, I mean, yes, the doctor technically is doing the surgery, but, you know, what is the responsibility? We could explore that a little bit if you have some suggestions for language.
I know what Medicare does, too. That would be useful in this regard.
That's a good question. Thank you.
Representative Kenemer and who?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just looking at the language here. It doesn't address the surgeon, which is a good point. However, if there's a reportable event, the facility would not be allowed to charge or would be in violation.
Representative Doherty?
The one question I had, and this dealt with Representative Kotet, with the fee if the bill is not sent, or if the bill is sent to the patient. My one concern is just because I've had the situation where I actually got a different patient's bill.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering whether there's any leeway on that. You know, I think it's a real good idea that a bill not be sent and this kind of thing, but there mistakes do happen. So I'm wondering whether there's any sort of parameters for that can be worked with.
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Doherty, you mean if... Well, certainly, I think we'd have to make sure this applies to accurate billing. In most cases, it would be, I would think the third party in most cases would be billed, i.e. the insurance plan would be the first line of payment ask, I would assume. But let me get back to you on that to clarify.
It was a civil penalty of actually $1 million. than what it was is they may impose a civil penalty in the manner provided by on a person for violation of Section 2, which was the billing of the,
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Doherty, I asked Legislative Council on what person meant, and person in this case does refer back to the facility and not the individual, like the person in the billing department.
Corporate person.
Right, corporate person. Okay. But we could make sure that that is indeed
that,
how
that
I interpret that.
That would make it very clear. Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's not close this one, but let's go back instead to 3559, which is still open, and get the neutral panel. Judy Moore Peterson and Janine Smith. You know, we haven't heard from you lately, Dr. Smith.
3164.
We're back on
3559.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Thompson and Greenlick. For the record, I'm Janine Smith, the Administrator of the Office of Health Policy and Research in the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm accompanied by Judy Moore Peterson, the Director of the Division of Medical Assistance Programs in the Authority. And we're here to talk about 3559, which impacts the Oregon Health Authority, including PEB and OEB, and especially, as noted in the Dash 2s, all other insurers regarding the standardization of payment. And it would allow a process in which to develop the exact specifics of that payment. But this did, as Representative Kotek mentioned, arise from the work of the Health Policy Board's Health Incentives and Outcomes Committee, which was a large, diverse group of stakeholders that met and had several recommendations about payment reform. And this was felt that the that this was a first step towards restructuring and creating a transparent process for payment. When we looked at hospital payments, there was discrepancy over how some of the hospitals in the state are paid in terms of what is called a diagnostic related group or DRG type sort of bundled payment. And as mentioned by previous testimony, others get paid on a discounted percentage of charges. If we're thinking about going forward with alternative payment and bundling of payments and some of the transformational changes that we see going forward, it was felt that it was important to have everyone kind of on the same baseline. What we also heard during the course of those committees is that some use different Medicare methodology. So you might be doing Medicare DRG payment methodology from 2008 with one hospital, and you might be doing it with 2010 version with another hospital. So the thought was that we should all be using the same one at the same time, so we all had the same base. And then if you're going to share savings between a plan and a hospital, it could be more easily understood as to what you were dealing with. It was also felt like it was, although the payment for providers was slightly less of a, it wasn't an ideal sort of bundled payment. It's the relative value based, resource-based relative value scale, as mentioned in your notes, was it was perhaps not as optimal, but it was what everyone was already having to use for Medicare, and at least it was a starting point. And we understand in both cases that there are some details that will have to be worked out through that work group in terms of certain populations, such as children, that it's not always well done in the Medicare system. But the idea was that we at least all started on the same platform, could all understand it and use it to go forward. And then I'll turn it over to Judy to talk a little more about Medicaid specifically.
Great. For the record, my name is Judy Moore Peterson. I'm the Director of Medical Assistance Programs at the Oregon Health Authority. I just wanted to talk a little bit about what the impact of this bill on Medicaid specifically. Currently, we already pay on a Medicare basis for the majority of the services. However, that's not passed along or not necessarily the case for Medicaid managed care plans. And this would allow us to move in that direction. The other thing is, as we were looking at this particular bill, it does allow us to build on or the health systems transformation work and looking at other alternative payment methodologies, such as bundled payments, shared savings, and capitation for health services provided either in hospitals or other healthcare providers. There are some questions about the timing of this. This would go into effect starting January 2013, there's some question as to whether we might want to move at a faster pace, but we're happy to work with the author on some suggested language adjustments that would help the implementation of this particular bill. And also, I just wanted to point out that on the dash twos, on section nine, goes beyond the public payers. It goes beyond PEB, OWEB, and Medicaid, and it extends to all insurers. Just wanted to make sure that that was clear. And that was it. If you have any questions.
Great, thank you. Any questions? Okay, the against panel next. Tom Holt, Patty O'Sullivan, and Dave Fiskum.
And again, Mr. Co-Chair, while they're coming up, we have passed out written testimony from ODS that makes some comments to bring to your attention on House Bill 3559 for the record.
Why you guys are here, you have my permission also to talk about why the hospitals are opposed to the never event thing. But you don't need to. The next one. I've been sort of anxious to hear that testimony.
I feel trapped in the middle here, so I will yield to my colleagues on either side of it.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record again, Tom Holt, on behalf of Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon on House Bill 3559. This bill, as we read it, is actually about a lot more than having everyone operate on the same general methodology of payment. It's also about setting rates. As we read it, Section 2, particularly at the top of page 2, where it talks about providers of healthcare services shall bill and accept as payment in full or reimbursement amount determined in accordance with the payment methodology, et cetera, certainly strongly implies that the state would not only determine a methodology based on Medicare, but would actually determine the multiplier of the Medicare scale that payers would have to use. And while in theory, at least in a fee-for-service kind of world that in many respects we're trying to move away from, having everyone at least operate off in the same language or off the same song sheet of what the methodology is, it makes some sense. That's the departure point for which at which negotiations about price begin. And from our perspective, it's not necessarily a place appropriate for the state to insert itself in deciding what rate we may pay. We may actually do better than what might be done through a rulemaking process in our negotiations with providers that might otherwise be done. But we're also concerned, similar to the other bill that we heard today, that it might restrict to some degree our ability to innovate in payment methodology as we work in collaboration to the extent that we can with the provider community to align incentives in the right ways. So with that, I'll close my comments. I'd be happy to take questions.
Mr. Chair, committee members, co-chairs, pardon me. For the record, Dave Fiskum here for Providence Health and Services, and you know who we are, so I won't bore you with those details. Listening to the testimony that precedes me today, I come to you, I think, on behalf of Providence with some mixed emotions. I'm a person who likes lists, and I've got 4 points to make to you fairly quickly today, so I will do those four. Providence supports the transformation of healthcare delivery and financing through new clinical care models and payment models. We believe this transformation will improve quality and health outcomes and help reduce unexplained variation in care delivery. This is a foundational element for those persons, the Gang of 43 or whatever the moniker is, who are meeting across the street at Willamette on Wednesday evenings to deal with triple aim issues. The second point I'd make
double
to you,
double aim.
Pardon me?
Double aim.
We believe there are some positive benefits to using standardized payment methodologies. It is important to note that that this change will not necessarily fix all of the misaligned incentives in fee-for-service reimbursement. This is an interim step. We think that contemplated in this bill, and in fact it may be a bit premature until we see the results of the transformation process, and I believe legislation, at least initial piece of legislation, might even be expected this week. My third point is that while standardization is generally a good direction, we caution that applying this approach too broadly at this time may in fact be, as I said, premature. We're mindful, as Representative Kotek said, that this work comes from those who have proposed it after some thought and study, and we applaud that. The hospital language, the hospital and ambulatory surgery center language that you see in the bill allows for exceptions to alternative payment methodologies, pay for performance, bundled payment or capitation, but there is no similar alternative that appears to be allowed for provider reimbursements. If you look at the contrasts between Section 1 sub 2 and Section 1 sub 3, there might need to be some synergy there with regard to those two sections. Mr. Holt has expressed a concern about the possibility this is both a payment methodology bill as well as a rate setting bill, and we share his concern in that regard. I would add that until today we hadn't seen the -2 amendments that are presented to you, and in skimming those, I noted with some concern and not sure what it all means, the Section 9 on page 1 and beyond on those -2 amendments, which have not been sent to Providence yet, where an insurer with a certificate of authority in this state shall use the uniform payment methodology prescribed by the Oregon Health Authority, et cetera, in establishing allowable charges for hospital and ambulatory surgical center services provided to enrollees in a health benefit plan offered by the insurer. To the extent that that might imply rate setting, we're concerned about that. As some of you know, if hospitals couldn't charge the commercial insurance industry more than the hospital costs, we would have no way to offset the under reimbursement that comes from the obligations that this legislature and the Congress create under Medicaid. Hospitals are paid, as you know, in the range of about 70% for our costs in Medicaid. That will go down toward 50 if the financial analysis and the governor's recommended budget is accurate. And we're concerned about that in the relationship between, on one hand, payment methodology reviews of the sort described in this bill, as well as the reality of budget cuts of that sort, which will have no other effect in the near term but to increase health insurance premiums. And people like me will be sitting here next session talking to you about why health insurance premiums went up. And part of that is the underfunding of Medicaid, perhaps as well Medicare. The last thing I would say, that my fourth point, besides the intervention on the -2 amendments, is that often in the past, I've appeared before committees to suggest that, in sort of in agreement with Mr. Taylor from CARE Oregon, that we are cautious about having the legislature interject itself between contractual arrangements which can be negotiated in goodwill and good faith between willing parties. It's often better to allow those negotiations to proceed, because all of us in the healthcare orbit need everybody else to provide services to the consumers we serve. If we were starting from scratch, I might say that again to you today, but because we aren't, we can support broadly with the changes I and others have outlined, at least the intent behind House Bill 3559. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm representing the Oregon Association of Hospital and Health Systems, and I am happy to come here and testify on this bill today. I concur with everything that Mr. Holt and Mr. Fiscom said, and I have just a couple of other things to add to that. Not mentioned here at all, even by the department, kind of surprisingly, was that there was a budget note last February in the 2010 February session
that asked the department to go back and convene a group, which they did, and there's a report that was given, I believe, at the September-October e-board on this very issue. It has some recommendations. It actually, they convened 25 hospitals, MCOs, and our association, and for three different meetings. Out of those meetings, they discussed payment methodology and payment reimbursement. Out of those meetings, they did come to some agreement on inpatient payments. They did not come to agreement on outpatient payments. So the recommendation, the final recommendation of that particular report, which this body convened them or ordered them to go do, was to take what they've already done and build on that and get the group back together and to keep going. I only mention that because we have a lot of reports and a lot of groups looking at this, and I really believe that with transformation and where we're going with that, we have the all payers, all claims, this would be another IT system. I really believe that it needs to be done in concert, and you know, payment reform is coming, but I think the people sitting at the table in that DMAP convened were coming to some agreement, and I used to say whether they can come to a full agreement or not. And I think that's a good place to have that conversation as opposed to just have a bill that sets a particular rate and doesn't include other rates. For instance, there are other types of payment limitations, APR DRG, which provides for severity adjustment and it has a more granular analysis of hospital utilization and patient care, taking into morbidity and things like that, and that Medicare payments are really focused on Medicare clients, and it's a completely different thing when you have a lot of children. And so there's other kinds of payment methodologies that look at the rates that should be, or not rates, sorry, but the methodologies that should be used with a population of children or a pregnant females or whatever it is. All these things need to be looked at together. They need to go ahead and get these groups back together and talk about this before we make any final decision on exactly what should be in a piece of legislation. And Representative Greenlick, if they need authority, we can come back in February and get that the exact authority that we need. And if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Thank you. You two are signed up for the next one. If you want to make a brief statement while you're sitting there on 2271.
Certainly, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, again for the record, Tom Holt from Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. In the spirit of the waning days of spring training, I just want to point out I'm 333 on Representative Kotek's bills today. We're in support of this one.
Excellent.
Regents, starting in the fall of 2009, stopped paying for never events, and we stopped paying both facilities and individual providers. And that was done, I understand, since precedes my time at Regents, but that it was largely because the Hospital Association did take a leadership position and adopted a policy internally that the facilities would not bill for these events. So we are happy that, you know, we've come to this point as a result of, you know, a lot of attention being focused on this issue in recent years. And it's also, by now in 2011, a few years into the discussion on this issue, it's what the market demands. What our sales folks tell me is that we basically never see an RFP these days that does not contain a provision that says, you know, thou shalt not pay for never events. So that's, you know, today it's where the market is, and we're happy to be there and be happy to provide you with a copy of our detailed policy that's out in the public display.
Mr. Fiskum?
Mr. Chair, for the record, again, Dave Fiskum here for Providence Health System. We, too, are not in opposition to House Bill 2271.
That's 167 you're batting, then.
I've got a golf joke in there somewhere, but I'm going to refrain from using it right now. I will have a letter for you in a tomorrow, signed by Dr. Glenn Rodriguez, the Providence Chief Quality Officer. It is being finalized. I could not get his signature before today, but I will provide it to you for the record. I just want to make a couple notes of excerpts from that draft, which I have before me. And again, I have four quick points, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence.
How about page two, so we get going?
The list. Providence supports the intent and aims of House Bill 2271 in terms of collecting for serious reportable events identified by the National Quality Forum. Providence has a policy to refrain from collecting costs associated with serious adverse events from an individual or a third party. In our billing procedures for these services, we follow the CMS regulation, which requires the adverse event to be listed on the claim with a specific designation, and then as part of our policy, we then reduce the DRG or charges related to the services associated with that event, so they in fact are not in that sense billed, nor do we collect for that. The challenge, and this is where it gets a little more complicated than the phrase never event, and I did some research over the weekend to understand the derivation of that term, and it is fairly complicated, even though it doesn't always pertain to the obvious adverse events, never events, Representative Kotek said, like operating on the wrong body part or the wrong person or associated events like that that we've all heard about. The challenge we face, it is not always possible to identify as a hospital system a never event at the time of its occurrence. For this reason, it may not be possible, even with the accurate billing procedures we have in place, to always suppress a billing for an adverse event. We do take care of that as soon as we know, because it's our policy not to collect for adverse events. Under the bill, this would lead to what could appear to be to us an excessive authorization for fining up to $1 million. When cases are not always as clear as the phrase never events suggests at the time of discharge and initial billing for a patient. We believe the true focus and your focus, our focus, should be on preventing these events from occurring in the first place, and we laud Representative Kotek's emphasis in that regard. We, in fact, have seen a significant reduction in the number of these events occurring in our major hospitals in 2009. It's been told to me that we had 52 reportable events at five DRG hospitals. In 2010, that number was reduced by more than half to 22 of those events. The fourth point is regarding the surgical checklist in Section 5. There may be an amendment that deals with this, so I won't burden you too much with the point that it, but I'll just say this. It may not make good sense to put a particular checklist in statute in case there are better checklists that emerge. We use, with great results, the American College of Surgeons National Surgical Quality Improvement Program at both Providence St. Vincent and Providence Portland Medical Center, and we believe that codifying this might hinder more comprehensive solutions in the future, and we'd have to return every year to make changes thereupon. And the last thing I would say for the record is that we are committed and have been for a long time to the work of the Patient Safety Commission. Dr. Rodriguez has in fact been a member of that, at least in the past, if not now, and I've lost track of the membership, but that's a very important contribution, we think, to good healthcare policy in Oregon. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Tower, do you want to make a very brief comment? I'm sorry, is there a question?
Mr. Holt, I guess, does this bill add anything? You know, my point is that I can't imagine the hospital billing for a never event, and God help them if and when they did. Every aspiring attorney would contact the nearest newspaper, and usually you don't like those kinds of headlines.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenemer, the word that I have is that if this bill were to pass, it essentially wouldn't change anything operationally that we do as a payer, because we don't pay the provider for an ever event, nor is this consistent with the other reimbursement that we do with our contracted providers. Neither do we allow the provider to what's called balance bill the patient for what they don't get paid by us.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Tower, you wish to make a very brief comment? We're running out of time.
Yeah.
We have several folks on the next.
Chair Greenlick, Chair Thompson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers, political director for Service Employees Union Local 503, testifying in support of House Bill 3559. I apologize for not being able to be in two places at once earlier on today.
We're in the wrong side.
Exactly, and I also apologize for really fighting off the flu here. But we do support this legislation. Currently, all hospitals in the state of Oregon see some Medicare patients and are familiar with the Medicare rates. Moving PAV and O up to an established set of rates the health systems in Oregon are familiar with helps the health system transitions. It will give PAV and OEP some control of rising health care costs. Aligning the approach for PAV, OEP, the insurance exchange, and the coordinated care organizations envisioned in the health system transformation team meetings, we can begin to start paying for needed services to make people healthier and incentivize providers accordingly. So we do support House Bill 3559, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll close the hearing on House Bill 3559 and continue along the line on the hearing on House Bill 2271. There's some informational folks who want to talk with. Let's start with Dr. Janine Smith again and Dr. Grant Higginson. I'll ask you all to be brief. I'd like to have a chance for you folks to talk to us, and we're running out of time. So the next panel will be Bethany Higgins, Diane Waldo, and Dan Grigg, please.
Co-Chairs Thompson and Greenlick, for the record, Janine Smith, the Administrator of the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research, and I'm accompanied by Dr. Grant Higginson from the Office of Community Health and Health Planning. In talking about 2271, which we are supporting, it would have several benefits. I think the key points here is this is a uniform policy that would be across all payers, and it sends a strong message about the importance of patient safety. It also adopts the national standard, like Medicare, which would allow for coordinated updates. So as Medicare advances their list of never events, it would subsequently trickle down to what we would want here in Oregon. And it's also timely because the National Quality Forum is now updating and will be expanding potentially that list, so that is key. It also extends the non-payment policy beyond just inpatient hospital settings to any healthcare facility, giving it a broader scope than the current voluntary commitment made by the Oregon Association of Health and Hospital Systems. So it would apply across hospitals, long-term care facilities, ambulatory surgical centers, freestanding birthing centers, and outpatient renal dialysis centers. I think as we move forward with the all-payer, all-claims database, that would be a means in which to do some of the monitoring to be able to implement this for you. And Grant wants to mention just briefly about the
Sure. Co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the administrator of the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, Public Health Division, Oregon Health Authority. And Dr. Smith has already talked about the authority's position on the policy implications of this bill, and I'm just here to talk about some administrative aspects. And this may all be moot now since Representative Kotek said that she may be changing this so that any regulatory function would actually be under the Department of Justice instead of the authority. But as it stands now, if this bill were to pass, it would become my responsibility with my program of health care regulation and quality improvement to perform the enforcement activities. And what we would be able to do within existing resources is whenever we were out doing a hospital or ambulatory surgical center survey, we would be able to check to make sure that the hospital or ASC did have a policy about never events, and we would also be able to follow up on any complaints about a facility that inappropriately charged. Similarly, with the checklist, when we were out doing our surveys, we would check to make sure that evidence-based surgical checklist was actually being used, and again, would be able within existing resources to do complaint investigations as well. If a more active or aggressive monitoring system was envisioned by this bill, we'd have to have further talks because that might require additional resources. Happy to answer any questions.
And
And I would just add that we'd be willing to work with the sponsors in terms of working out any of the language details of the bill going forward to make sure we can successfully implement it.
I've heard a rumor you're contemplating retiring. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Greenlick, yes, more than contemplating. The plan is sometime in May.
Well, then I want to put on the record how much the state owes you for your extraordinary career in public health. You've done it. An unbelievable job. How many years now?
Coming up on 24.
And as state health officer and other roles, and we owe you a great debt, and you'll be missed.
Well, thank you for the compliment. It's been a very interesting experience and mostly a pleasurable experience working with the legislature, and I very much appreciate the work that you do, so thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, thank you guys very much. Next panel. Got much after this. Laura Etheridge will be the last witness. Go for it, team.
All right. Good afternoon. Co-Chair Greenlick and Co-Chair Thompson and members of the committee. My name is Diane Waldo with the Hospital Association. I'm the Director of Quality and Clinical Services there. I'm here today to talk about House Bill 2271. And just to emphasize that hospitals are of the mind that a mandatory approach is not needed as far as non-payment of adverse events. You heard earlier today that the Hospital Association took a leadership role in creating and distributing a no-pay resolution. This actually was done on February 18th of 2008. And hospitals are on board with that on a voluntary basis. The resolution passed by the board established a set of uniform guidelines for hospitals to use to ensure consistent hospital billing and payment policies for preventable and serious adverse events. The resolution goes on to say that Oregon hospitals agree not to seek payment for costs associated with a preventable serious adverse event if the event was determined to be preventable and within the control of the hospital. The list of events included in the resolution is the same event list that is part of the Oregon Patient Safety Commission reporting program, and that is a subset of the NQF list of never events, not inclusive of the CMS hospital-acquired condition list. Our no-pay resolution goes further than House Bill 2271 talks about a no pay for any additional care that may be made necessary because the adverse event occurred, such as an increased length of stay or level of care, additional procedure or intervention required, or a readmission that may be required. Our resolution does not apply if, after investigation by the hospital, it's determined that the hospital could not have prevented the serious adverse event or the event was not under the hospital's control. Hospitals are responsible only for services that would be billed by them. Other providers are encouraged to similarly minimize the financial impact on patients and payers under such circumstances. In House Bill 2271, the fine of $1 million against a hospital is considered excessive. It may not be readily identified that an event was an adverse event or preventable if a billing statement inadvertently goes out before that determination is made. A hospital could certainly be fined a very large amount in error. If House Bill 2271 goes forward, it should really apply universally to all providers, not just hospitals. In summary, of course, the focus should be on preventing events from occurring in the first place. Hospitals are very committed to addressing the prevention of adverse events and the non-payment that would be associated with them. We don't believe a mandatory approach is needed. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Greenlick, Co-Chair Thompson, I am Bethany Higgins, and members of the committee, excuse me, I'm Bethany Higgins, the administrator for the Oregon Patient Safety Commission.
I don't think you need to be quite that close.
Okay. The Patient Safety Commission applauds the efforts of the hospitals and the insurers related to their commitment to nonpayment of the costs associated with preventable serious adverse events. We wanted to keep our comments very brief today, considering the time element here, and had more to add around the surgical checklist at the point we want to talk about that piece of it. But
great. We'll have lots of opportunity to be back, I think, on this one.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and Chair Thompson, members of the committee. My name is Dan Grigg. I am the director of Salem Hospital's Center for Patient Safety and Clinical Effectiveness. And I just want to comment briefly on the surgical checklist. It's not a new concept. It's something that's been in place for a number of years throughout the country. The Joint Commission back in 2004 required that all hospitals do a surgical timeout, and they recommended the checklist be part of that. When I came to Salem Hospital in 2005, our hospital was well in the process of implementing that. Now, with anything, sometimes we're good at implementing, sometimes we're not. So a couple years later, we took another look at that and realized there was some opportunity for improvement. And at the same time, we had implemented some pretty extensive training for all of our staff and physicians around communication and teamwork. And part of that training included creating tools to utilize the concepts around that. And so our Family Birth Center used that created the tool to improve their surgical timeout process, which included a checklist. And then in 2008, the Board of Trustees mandated that be expanded to all of the surgery areas. And so since 2008, we've had a really good process in place. When the World Health Organization published their checklist in 2009, we gathered a group of surgeons, anesthesiologists, nurses that work in the OR, and spent several months making sure that what we had created earlier matched up with the best evidence that was in place in the WHO checklist in 2009. Now, since that time, there's been constant iterations and constant auditing. We're currently at 99.4% use of the surgical checklist in the OR, and I'm pretty confident that if you came to Salem Hospital's OR today, you would see the anesthesiologist leading a timeout before putting the patient to sleep. You'd see the surgeon leading the timeout before making the incision, and you would also see a nurse leading a pause before taking the patient into the recovery room. And so we're doing all we can to keep patients safe. In fact, that's my entire professional existence is about that, making sure that patients that come into our hospital are safe in our care and getting the best possible care.
Thank you. I think we will ask you back when we work this bill to give us a little more information on the checklist, but it sounds kind of interesting. Thank you. Laura, you want to join us? But before you do, I need to do a little business. I have a motion.
But you need to go into work session.
I need to go into a work session on the bill?
Yeah.
And that bill was 2740. I have a work session on House Bill 2740.
Mr. Chair, I request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow Representative Parrish to record her vote on House Bill.
And Representative Cannon.
Oh,
and Representative Cannon.
I'm sorry. I didn't.
Me too.
To.
Sorry.
Both of them.
Both
yeah,
of them.
Right.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, how do you vote? And the bill that went to...
It was unanimous.
Call the roll on the last two.
Well,
Cannon and Parrish, please.
Representative Parrish?
I'm actually no vote on this one.
Okay. Representative Cannon?
You're a no vote because you weren't here and you don't have to.
No, I'm a no vote.
Oh, no, a zero, okay.
May
not a zero.
Vote.
I thought you said...
Nay.
A nay and a yay.
Yeah. Right.
Thank you very much. Propose a work session on House Bill 2740.
And then reopen.
Oh, I never close the work session. I mean, the hearings.
Okay.
Both hearings are still open. Why don't I close where we're at the public hearing on House Bill 3559, leaving still open the public hearing on House Bill 2271. And you're almost the only thing standing between us and going home, so just
all right.
Take your time.
No pressure.
Mr. Chair Greenlick and Chair Thompson, members of the committee, my name is Laura Etherton. I'm the healthcare advocate for OSPIRG. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan consumer organization. I will be very brief. I just want to convey our support for House Bill 2271. This is a common sense move forward to reduce healthcare costs in a way that will improve quality by reducing errors. It makes sense to, on the prohibition for paying for never events, it makes sense to build on the existing work that should be applauded of the insurance, insurers and the hospital association, and to link with the overall work that's going forward through the National Quality Forum list of never events. And then on the checklist, we're also supportive of that component. And wanted to agree with Mr. Fiskin's comment that it may make sense for, as actually it does say, I believe, in the bill, that that specific checklist would be determined by rule as opposed to set in the law, so that as it evolved, that could continually evolve without having to come back to this body. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, Laura. I close the work session on House Bill 2271. I mean the public hearing on it. I do want to make an announcement. Representative Thompson and I have decided we are going to work House Bill 3137, which will be the House's version of the exchange bill. We'll have an amendment coming in that will replace the existing form of 3137, and as soon as we can get that, we'll schedule a hearing on it. We, as you know, we are going to work, as we said last Monday, 2329, which would be our version of the transformation bill, unless there's agreement on a joint committee. I hear we're getting closer to agreement on a joint committee, so that may be the case. But if we're not working 2390, we will be working 3137 with the hope that we can get something that's acceptable across the broad membership of the House, and then can send it down to Ways and Means, where everything, where all will be resolved as it usually is resolved.
Right.
Comments? We are adjourned. Jim?
I've asked for an amendment.